dogs. I better stay up here now.
No clicker, right?
Yep.
Cool.
Yeah, I did. Well, it's all my whole career, basically. Yeah. 11 years now at West.
Okay.
Okay, we're getting ready to start our current events thing. And I always start off by telling everybody how we started doing this. 24th annual meeting. At our second annual meeting, Hal Lindsey came and spoke on Tuesday night, and he gave a paper, and after he delivered his paper, everybody started asking the questions about current events. And so we started doing current events on Tuesday nights because we believe that our view of prophecy, being the futurist view, actually relates to history. And we believe that we're seeing the preparation for the events that take place after the rapture. Now, Dr. Walvoord, who attended up until the year he died here every year, used to say, when you're in the mall and you see decorations of Christmas, you know that Thanksgiving is near. Because the rapture is signless, you can't date her. I asked her out for a date, and she said, I don't date. And therefore, there are no signs for the rapture, right? And the reason why is because we're to be waiting and watching at any moment. Always, if there were signs, you'd be looking for the signs, right? But Christ could come at any moment. But after he comes, then there are hundreds of events that are going to take place after the rapture and then on into the tribulation. And in Matthew 24, it says that when you see this, the end is not yet. Talking about early things in the tribulation period. Then you see this, the abomination of desolation, the end is not yet. And then it says, when you see this, talking about the second coming, then look up for your redemption draws near. So you can see the signs leading up to the second coming. So we can develop a framework of people, places, and things like that, and we're seeing that the stage is being set and prepared for this. And I think a basis for that is 2 Thessalonians 2, which says the mystery of iniquity, referring back to the man of lawlessness, the Antichrist, is already at work. In other words, throughout the church age. Only he who restrains will do so until he's taken out of the way. So there's an upper limit of what God, the Holy Spirit, is going to allow preparation to be, but that passage also implies or says that there is preparation, or Satan is trying to move history in the direction of setting up for the tribulation period, you see. So I think that gives us a justification for looking at current events as they may be leading us toward that. So tonight we're going to have Wilfred Hahn, and he is an international banker, or was an international banker, right? That's not the way you'd like it put, right?
Something like that.
Yes, but he was in charge in Canada of one of the largest bank investment group or something like that, and I believe you said last time you spent half of your time over in Europe hanging out with those people. He's got a real grasp of the international banking system and economic stuff, and he has some really good insights into what's happening. And last time he showed us that the whole world, even Switzerland, is locked into this international banking system, which we believe, you know, at some point will be used by the Antichrist to prevent people from buying and selling. And so he's going to talk to us about these kinds of things. So Wilfred?
Well, thank you, Tommy. Again, a privilege to be here and to speak again at the current events. I'm a Canadian, you probably know, and sad thing I have to report is that we just lost our pro-Zionist prime minister. I don't know if you've been following that. Whereas once Canada was one of the very, very few pro-Zionist countries, even to the point of getting kicked off the Security Council, or at least not having had the opportunity to serve on the revolving Security Council at the UN. Now we got a new prime minister, and he hasn't made any pronouncements just yet, but it's not going to be nearly as pro-Zionist as before, and I hope it's not going to get real terrible. But anyway, again, it's a pleasure to be here, and I just want to say a couple things about what I'm going to present here, my background. We did circulate a newsletter that our ministry puts out called Eternal Value Review. It is available free. Please look at find the web address there, and you can go to it and sign up. I'll tell you, it's a very different letter. It's probably the only dispensationalist global macroeconomic publication out there. But we do try to tie together what's going on in the world today, the accelerating patterns that we see, and tying it into Scripture and how it all fits in over the long term. And that's what I want to do here a little bit as well. Tommy already gave me a little bit of an introduction. Maybe I'll just give you a little bit more of a background. I was a director of research for a Wall Street firm for some time, already many years ago, and then as Tommy already mentioned, I was chairman of the global investment operations of Royal Bank of Canada, which is the largest bank, large even in American terms. And in those days, I traveled a lot internationally, and I picked up some Dave Hunt books at some point early in my career. And I was radicalized. And I might add, a lot of authors I've read from the Pre-Trib Research Council, and they had a great influence on me. And just what I was observing around the world just seemed to put some of the Bible prophecy to life for me. And so that was the start of our ministry, and ever since then, my career's been downhill, being exposed as a dispensationalist economist. Anyhow, let's get lots to cover here, current events, and I want to talk about a number of things, but first I want to just condition you, as I did last year. If you want that presentation from last year, you'll have to go to the Timothy LaHaye website, I guess, and order that, and I did more of a foundational perspective on how the whole globe is evolving. Today I'm not going to do that. I'm going to talk to some specific issues, but I do want to just take a moment to set the foundation here, why money, economy, all that sort of thing is associated with prophecy and is spoken about in the Bible. Economies are human, right? And so if there weren't humans, there wouldn't be economies in financial markets, so it obviously has to be all tied in. But the Bible does speak about just a couple of quick points. A deep commercialism, prophecy does tell us about. The world will be driven by a common idolatry of money and commerce. A number of references in the Bible there. Economic oppression and wealth distribution disparities worldwide. We see some reference to that made in James chapter 5, verses 1 through 6. These are all prophesied things, and again, as you can see, they're related to money and commercialism. Deep indebtedness of governments. I think Habakkuk chapter 2, verse 7 does prove that. And trends through globalism, globalization, and post-globalism, the period that I think we're going to be up against here pretty soon. And there's many, many references to that in the Bible. And lastly, I just want to point out, and this is the big, big boogaboo for everybody in the world who has to deal with financial markets in some respect, we're in a time of pervasive corruption, immoral policy, and that period of lying and stealing that Zechariah talks about in chapter 5. So that sets a little bit of a tone here for where we're coming from with a biblical perspective now as we turn to talk about some of the things going on in the world right now. It literally is a hotbed right now of change. And as I call it, Westphalian political economics is rapidly driving this humanist world towards its outcome in the tribulation period. Some really, truly phenomenal transitions are occurring. Even myself, who's been in that field for almost 40 years, when I see what is happening and how quick, I myself, as a researcher and analyst, can't even believe it. Policymakers around the world are confused. I'm going to talk about that a little bit and how that has an impact on everyone as they're dealing with some very asymmetric policy risks. And the one thing I want to point out here, none of my presentation is meant to, you know, cause a fear mongering. That's not what I'm here to do. I'm just wanting to explain what's happening. And I'm not here to sell gold or anything else like that. We're just, you know, we're going to just talk about what's happening in the world and try to put a biblical perspective on it. So don't fear, relax. You can go. You don't have to hold on to your purse. We're just going to focus on the facts here. First thing I want to talk about, a very interesting one, is China. Everybody must be aware that a lot of things are going on in China. So I want to dive into that because I think there's always also a biblical perspective we want to talk about. Now have a look at that picture. That is Shanghai in 1970. Now here, look at it now. I'll do that one more time. So I'll go back to the previous one. And so that's a little more than 40 years. What has gone on in China is really unbelievable, and I think it was not chance, and there's some interesting motives behind it, agendas behind it. So let's talk about it. Here's a research outfit that we subscribe to, and just listen to this statement. We believe that the single most important macro trend of our time, China's attempt to transform itself from a typical emerging market into an empire. That's the biggest thing that's going on right now, and certainly from where I sit, that is true. The Napoleon Bonaparte's prediction way back when, turn of the 1800s, said when China wakes, it will shake the world. And we're indeed that period of time right now, and I'm going to show you what's happening. I'll just, touch on some things that have happened recently. You know, for a long time, China has slumbered, but all of a sudden, since the late 1970s, just erupted on the world stage. Lately, some of the things that have happened that are quite significant, I'll just point out. It's just in the process of joining the world stock market indices. To this point, you know, the Chinese stock market has been, you know, a lot like what a Middle East map would look like. It hasn't had Israel on it. And that's how institutional investors look at China. If you're not in the map, if you're not in the indices, they're not going to invest in that country. So that's what's happened here recently. They're going to be part of that. It's amazing how large the Chinese stock market already is. They've just recently gained recognition, the IMF, and now part of the special drawing reserve, or right, pardon me. So they're part of that IMF international structure. And it's interesting that they already got granted that status, because I think the IMF was definitely rushing it. China, in response to some of the hindrances, if you will, of the U.S. against some of the initiatives of the IMF just a number of years ago, finally said, look, we're going to start a parallel world ourselves. Recently, they launched the Asian Infrastructure Investment Bank, and 56 countries in the world signed up. So this is a competing system to the World Bank IMF group, sort of Western-based countries. That's happened just recently. It's very, very significant. Very interesting as well, China is working very, very hard to build a network. They already are the manufacturing hub of Asia overall, but they're working very hard to try to connect all these countries out in Asia through what they call the Silk Road Marine Belt Initiative. We're going to talk about that a bit, but it is very, very significant. So many things are going on so rapidly in China, it's beyond fascinating. And I'll mention as well from a geopolitical point of view, China has been beefing up its naval capabilities, its military capabilities, and so forth. Now, I want to just give you a bit of a sense of how enormous this change in China has been and how enormous the impact has been on the rest of the world. Consider the home ownership boom that China has experienced. They have gone from 0% household ownership to 60% household ownership in the space of less than 25 years. You remember the big real estate crisis that America had? Well, that started already when there was a home ownership rate about 65, and I think it went up to 69. But here you have the largest, most populous country in the world go from 0% to 60% in 25 years. It's phenomenal. It's never happened before in the history of mankind. Today, the exports from China account for more than a third of its economy. And in just the space of 25 years, it used to be only 6%. These are trends and changes that are absolutely phenomenal. China is just absolutely dominating all the export markets here in North America. Anything that you can, you know, is shippable, throw in a box, China will have, or some Southeast Asian or Asian country will have the majority market share in those categories. And that's all happened, again, in the last 23, 40 years. And that's incredibly short when you look at the long macro timelines. Here's a quick glimpse so you can get a sense of just how big this impact has been on the rest of the world and everyone in this room. Consider, for example, iron ore consumption. I won't go through all of them, but 55% of iron ore is consumed by China today. Remember, just 25 years ago, it was less than 2% of the world economy. Look at any major commodity, oil or whatever else, China over the past number of decades has just dominated the consumption of which, and it's related to some of the commodity prices that we're seeing here right now. What I'm trying to do here is just give you a sense of how enormous this change has been in China, and we want to ask some questions here in just a minute as to why, what's behind it. So the whole economic nexus point of the world has shifted back. China used to be the world's largest economy for 20-some centuries, at least. And then 1800s sort of fell off the truck, so to speak. And only recently is muscling its way back onto the world scene, certainly the economic scene. So the center of gravity of the world economy is now moving back in a very short space of time back to Asia. Now, why is China rising? What's behind all this? Basically, the main reason, and Xi Jinping, who is the new general secretary of the Communist Party there, his express goal and the Communist express goal is that they want China to regain the grandeur and the might that they had previously. They want to do that by 2050. That's an overriding goal, and that's the way they want to go. Interestingly, a paper here written by seen by the Financial Times out of Germany, and they expressed the comment that, and a warning in fact, that China seems driven by geopolitical rather than economic goals with potentially dire consequences for the European Union. Point here is, that I want to focus on, is China suddenly at one point decided that they want to rebuild their grandeur. Back in 1978, that's when it really started. Deng Xiaoping started some reforms, and it's really since 1978 that we've seen this rapid eruption of China and Southeast Asia on the world. I won't spend much on this chart, but there's this verification of, if you look at the red line, how big China was going back to the 1500s, and how, again, it's now coming back on the world scene. And in very short order, if things go on the trends that we're seeing now, it'll be the biggest economy in the world. Now, 7 of the 10 largest shipping ports in the world are in Asia, so that gives China quite a bit of power, particularly as they're expanding their naval might. And so there's a lot of choke points out there in the South Sea, China, and so forth. Gives them a lot of power, and it's part of this, what I already mentioned, the One Belt, One Road. China has some very, very aggressive programs, spending programs, investment programs around the world. China is today the biggest global investor in world infrastructure, bigger than the U.S. They are building alliances all over the place, Africa, particularly in the Asian area, because their goal is to tie all these countries, particularly in Asia, all together into one group that coordinates itself and becomes together a challenge for the Western world. So that's a serious agenda that's underway. So the question then comes to everybody's mind then, of course, what could be the potential consequences yet in the future? Asking questions such as, could China and other Asian nations dominate the world overtaking the U.S.? Could that happen? They certainly have in some areas. Their economy isn't as large yet, but lots of economists are predicting that within 10 to 15 years at the outside. Could the Chinese currency now become the new world reserve currency? The American dollar has been the reserve currency of the world for quite some time, certainly since before the Second World War. But that's the question on the lips of many people. What role does East China have in end-time geopolitics and prophecy? That's an interesting. We're going to dive into that one here in just a second. And are recent shifts in East Asia already prophetically significant, or could they be as an event that we can label as stage setting? So I want to answer those questions. I'm going to take some risks on some of my opinions here. My view is, and I call it an assertion, that the developments in East Asia that we're seeing today, not just China, but East Asia overall, do have prophetic significance. I'll give you some reasons why. But firstly, you know, an important marker for me when I look at world trends going back decades, centuries, if one sees developments that come on the scene, erupt on the scene, and happen rapidly, and if it's after 1948, and I pick 1948 because, of course, we know that the Jews were back in their land as of that point. And so anything that sort of happens in that window from 1948 on, not exclusively, but if we do see something, you know, you should get suspicious. Something's going on here. What's going on behind it? And if these things have a massive global impact and, aren't, you know, I'll call it a mammon spirit or geopolitically driven type of development, and as I already said, incredible and inexplicable, as the case may be in China, you really, you know, it's not, I think it's a reasonable presumption to say something's going on here, something this big must have significance, and in some sense could be a stage-setting development for other prophecies to unfold, as the Bible tells us. Now, I'm going to take just a little bit of a detour here and pull in two other factors which are very interesting in the story of what's happened to China. It is interesting that China had a number of diasporas starting in 1909 through to 1945. There were a number of periods of uprisings and political strife, and a number of groups and quite a large number of Chinese had exit, especially as the communists took over in the late 1940s as they took the one against the Kuomintang. And so interestingly, already starting way back then, these Chinese fanned out all over East and South Asia. And the interesting thing that happened is that they became the commercial, the business people, even though they were the majority populations in places like Philippines, Malaysia, Thailand. I can go list a whole bunch of them. They're the majority, but they are the largest business owners. Almost like, some similarities to the Jews in a number of respects here. So isn't it interesting that all these Chinese were out there already fanning out over Asia as China became, again, stirred, you know, started growing, started coming back onto the world scene. The fact that there were all these Chinese all around Asia already really enabled the rapidity of the economic development of China. All these family groups worked with the mainland, Hong Kong, so on and so forth. It really, really helped the economic expansion that we saw in South Asia. Very interesting fact, but it did have a role, and again, it is part of this, you know, what I'm just seeing to be a phenomenal trend, hardly to be explained. Second fact I want to throw in here out of interest is that China does have some enormous demographic problems. They had, as was the case also with some other Asian countries like South Korea, they preferred to have, as you know, you could only have one child, up until recently anyway. That was the policy, you could only have one child in China. So most households preferred to have a male. And so what happened, unfortunately, is this particular article here that I'm quoting shows, is that a very large imbalance happened. A lot more men there than there are women, by a significant margin. And so what could that, what does that contribute? An interesting opinion here, I'm going to read the whole thing, because I think it's quite significant, that China, this being the largest, well, most populous country in the world, that it has such a gender imbalance. Throughout human history, young men have been responsible for the vast preponderance of crime and violence, especially single men in countries where status and social acceptance depend on being married and having children, as it does in China and India. A rising population of frustrated single men spells trouble. Over the next generation, many of the problems associated with sex selection will get worse. Within 10 years, China faces the prospect of having the equivalent of the whole young male population of America, or almost twice that of Europe's three largest countries, with little prospect of marriage, untethered to a home of their own, and without the stake in society that marriage and children provide. Just consider the impact of that. South Korea also had a huge gender imbalance back in the early 1970s. Today, even, 10 or 11% of all marriages involve a foreign woman. And can you imagine what that impact would be if China started doing that with that many single men? If you're a polygamist, you don't want to see churches over there right now. But what an imbalance. And the interesting thing about it, the potential about it, is that you're going to have all these single men around for a number of decades yet. They've got not a lot to do, and certainly could be, as this quote from The Economist put out, could be up to no good, certainly on the international scene. So what do I think about China? Is China going to overtake the world? Back to the questions that I posed earlier. Are they going to become the next reserve currency of the world? Are they going to become the most powerful country? I'm just going to give you my opinion as a secular analyst's perspective. I'm not saying I'm secular, but I'm just taking an economist's perspective, if you will. China's population is aging at the fastest rate ever. Already, their workforce is shrinking. So that's a really bad sign. By 2050, almost a fifth of their population will be over 65 years of age. That doesn't allow for them to maintain a strong economy longer term. It's not going to hit them just yet, perhaps, but it's a negative factor for them longer term. In a very quick order, just as they've quickly burst out of the world scene, they've taken on some of the bad habits of the Western world. They now have debt levels that are huge. It's incredible how quickly they've done that, so that's already a big negative. They have to feed almost a fifth of the world's population. They only have 7% of the world's arable land. So it's interesting that a country that large, which is that big of a trader, materials good trader around the world, doesn't have a lot of basic resources, and a big disadvantage there. And the bottom line is already intimated, is there's just no way that what we've seen happening in China to date, again, in a space of 25 to 40 years, becoming such a large, enormous country with such a big footprint economically around the world, they can't repeat that. It's a one-time thing that'll never happen again. They moved almost 300 million people from the countrysides and moved them into the cities, large cities. And that's another thing that can't be repeated. So my answer is, I think all the worries are a little overrated, but that doesn't mean that we're not going to have problems for quite some time. But longer term, just looking at some of the problems that they have, I wouldn't get too carried away. But that's in the future. What does the Bible say? I think that's interesting. There's not many verses in the Bible that give us any prophetic insight as to what's going to be going on in Asia, but there are one or two. I want to share those with you. The first one, we find that in Revelation 16:12, reads, "And the sixth angel poured out his vial upon the great river Euphrates, and the water thereof was dried up, that the way of the kings of the east might be prepared." So that seems pretty easy to understand literally. It talks here about the river Euphrates being dried up, and something happens that the kings of the east go west, they go across that. And given that this is Revelation 16, probably sometime the second half of the tribulation period, I don't think those kings of the east are bringing tidings of good joy. So we don't know what's going to drive them to do that. But let's accept that that is a Bible reference that speaks about some things going on in the east, certainly east of the Euphrates. Now, many take this next verse, Revelation 9,
verses, rather Revelation 9, 12, and 14, also as a significant verse that has some prophetic implications for Asia or parts of Asia. I personally don't. I think it's something probably more spiritual. Many try to figure out where those 200 million mounted troops will come from. I basically end up leaving this one alone because I just don't think I can make a strong enough case that that has direct prophetic implications that we can understand for economies or for China. There is one other one which I have up here next, and that's Revelation 17:10. I think 17:10 and 17:12. I think here is an insightful perspective for us as to what happens to China and Asia longer term. So here we're dealing with, of course, the section in Revelation which talks about the big beast with the seven heads and the ten horns, and explains what that signifies. And it talks about the seven kings here. Five have fallen, one is, you know, the popular interpretation. I think in our circle would be that the one that is still the Roman head, and the other one has not yet come, but when he does come, he must remain for only a little while. So this next phase of world rulership is still yet to come. And the next verse then links us in here into China. It says, the ten horns that you saw, however, ten horns are on the heads, I believe only one head, of the beast. Here it talks about them and says, are ten kings who have not yet received a kingdom. And I think that's an important key. So this being prophesied in John's day would mean that those future ten kings that he's seeing, that'll come onto the scene for a very short period of time, have not yet had a kingdom in his day or prior. So what that means to me is that countries such as China, which existed before John gave these prophecies, Persia, and others, we could posit, possibly Japan, they were around already before this prophecy was made. So if you use that key, it says that China will not be a significant component of the future global Ten King Coalition. And I think that is important to know. But it does open up a lot of questions, doesn't it? Why is that going to happen? What is the implication for the rest of the world as that plays out? And I want to talk about that a bit as well. Okay, well, maybe it's going to come up next. There it is. There's that beast. I'm taking a little bit of license there quickly. And you'll see that the ten horns... We had made a little bit of a correction. I appreciate this artist, Mrs. Marvenko, Pat Marvenko, does a great job on these things. But unfortunately, we had to change and put the ten horns on the one head. I think I can prove that, but I'm not going to do that today. But in any case, what we're saying is China will not have a role in that Ten King Coalition at that future date. Now, interesting thing, just as an aside here, one of the things that I've discovered over the years, especially having worked on this Ten King project and written a number of articles on it, looking at hordes of statistics from countries all around the world, is the interesting power of number 10. And pose any question to me or give me any indicator, and likely what you'll find is that the top 10 countries... will be the majority. I'll just illustrate. For example, the top 10 trading currencies in the world, they account for over 90% of exchange around the world. So just 10 countries, there's 195 countries in the UN right now, probably 220 countries and protectorates and so forth. So it only takes 10 to account for the majority. Here's another factor. This is the distribution of arable land across countries around the world. The top 10 countries with the most arable land account for 57.6. So again, only 10 countries account for the majority in this particular indicator. I can keep going. Armed forces, the top 10 countries in terms of armed forces, again, have over 50%. Population distribution around the world. It only takes the top 10, and you've got a majority. I can go on. Largest economies in the world, the top 10 biggest economies, account for 66.3% of the world economy. So isn't it interesting? It just takes 10. So that gives some credibility to this number 10 that we know at some point. I'm talking here about the global 10 King Coalition. It certainly will have enough power. It only need 10 to have enough power to dominate the world at that point in time. That was just a little diversion here, but I thought that's interesting, so I just was going to point it out to you. Well, I'm going to now take a turn. I've talked about China. I hope you get the sense of the significance of what's happening in China and how it's going to play out. We're going to come back to a conclusion on that in a moment. But it is a phenomenal trend and something we shouldn't lose sight of, and the potential implications thereof as well. Well, everybody knows there was a global financial crisis. My point of view is it still exists. It's just morphed into different forms all around the world. So we've had 7 years of fairly tough times internationally, and also to some extent in North America. Big question, therefore, is what happens next? As the, you know, we've had 7 thin years, are we going to get 7 good years? And I think the answer, and I'm going to tie this answer into why we're going to see what we're seeing already, and we'll still expect to see in the monetary field. So I'll come back to that and tie this in. But my answer is no. We're living in a very, very different time. The policymakers around are confused. They're making up policy as they go. They're groping. As I said already, they're desperate. It's a very, very different environment in the world, and I want to just mention quickly some of the reasons why that is and why they're going to continue to be confused and why they are taking some of these aggressive policy changes and monetary policies. I'll come back to that in a second. I'm going to name just 7 things. One of the big shibboleths of world outlook is continuing growth and trade. And that's been the big, big mantra now for at least 100 years. Globalization. Keep trade growing. Well, the interesting thing is, for the first time now, for 7-8 years, almost, well, this particular case will show the 10-year period, global trade isn't growing anymore. Surprise, surprise. This is confusing a lot of people. Debt. Well, you hear a lot about debt. One of the facts about debt and crises is crises periods never are over until debt levels have been brought down somewhat. Every single crisis ever studied and recorded through modern economic history going back 180 years, every single crisis, such as the global financial crisis that have happened, first needed to see debt come down. Now, that's happened to an extent in America, but it certainly has not happened worldwide. As I'm showing you here, world's up, these numbers are incredible, over 200 trillion. So that's another humdinger. It's not going as per course as things should have been. We're seeing productivity rates fall off. This is another one of those shibboleths of modern growth theory, right? You got to have productivity growth. Truth is, we haven't had any great new technologies for a long, long time, and that's another negative that's confusing policymakers. Demographics, we talked about that in China, the fact that those populations are getting older, that's also true for the entire world on average. And that's a bad thing. That means that world economies are going to lumber. They're going to be under strain. They're going to be growing slower. We have also an extreme distribution of wealth in the world. It's becoming much, much worse. As you can see here, that's the Gini coefficient. The higher it goes, it means the more inequitable is the spread of wealth. So that's, I would even venture the opinion that we have a wealth skew today that's probably worse than or equal to the worst days in the Roman Empire 2,000 years ago. It's a very bad problem. It's a very bad problem, and part of it is a cause of the low interest rates. And that's the chart I show you next. You all have probably will know that interest rates have fallen, but they have fallen to 500-year lows. And some I saw one economist make the case that it was a 5,000-year low. But rates are incredibly low, and why is that? It's absolutely terrible for the retirement classes. If you thought you could retire on 4% interest rate a number of years ago, well, you're going to have to save 4 times as much money to have this, enjoy the same lifestyle. So it's a very terrible thing, but you don't hear economists talk about that. They talk about inflation. Oh, no, there's no inflation. Retirement income has had a huge inflation, but they don't look at it that way. quick point I want to make here about central banks. Seventh point why the world economy is not going to rebound as normally would have been the case after past crises, and why countries and policymakers are going to strain and try to keep things going or hold things together, is this particular chart I want to show you here. And I think you all know that central banks have been very, very active. Unprecedented policies they've taken on, trying to get economies to go again. And interesting parallel here with the Second World War. You know that central banks have been in a similar position before. At the end of the Second World War, central banks were trying to help the, you know, war effort, and they bought government bonds, and they really got over indebted to the point, as you can see, as we're seeing here recently again, as central banks recently have borrowed money, bought, you know, I won't get into all the technicalities, but the central bank's balance sheets are way, way over levered. It's to the point of the same level that we had in the Second World War. What's different this time is it's a financial war, not a military war. The solutions to the debt problem that the central banks, the world central banks, had at that point back in the 1940s came naturally. All the soldiers came home from the war, started families, all the technologies that were developed during that wartime period were then put to work in the peacetime economy. You had booming households. It was only 10, 15 years the whole thing sorted out. Growth roared away, and that debt disappeared. This time, we do not have that possibility. This is not, this debt increase is a function of a financial war and not a military war, and unfortunately, that has some dire consequences longer term. Well, so what we have among central bankers around the world is a war. They're fighting each other. I think we're coming up to the 900th interest rate cut of the last 7 years. They're fighting to try to get their currency to be weaker than the next country so they can get more trade and so forth. It's a real free-for-all out there. And the central banks are jumping in there as well, as already mentioned. I'd love to get into the technicalities, but we don't want to get lost in that. The point is the central banks are basically creating assets out of thin air. Now, the problem is that it's not working that well. Even though interest rates are as low as they are, and some of these central banks around the world, like the Bank of Japan, they're basically completely funding their budget deficits out of paper. They're just creating it and buying all the government bonds. And that's also the case now for Europe for the next number of years. The European Central Bank will be buying out more bonds than governments will be issuing over the next couple of years. All fabricated money. Unfortunately, it hasn't had a big impact yet. Last year I had the opportunity to give you some more insights as to the changes in philosophy. But I'm not going to go over that again. I'll just talk about some new things. The latest policy solution that the central bankers are coming up with, this idea of negative interest rates. How would you feel to have the privilege to deposit your money in the bank and pay the bank a fee? In other words, they wouldn't pay you an interest rate. They'd charge you an interest rate to hold it. Now, that sounds strange, doesn't it? But that's the case already in quite a number of countries around the world. Switzerland has a negative overnight deposit rate of 0.7%. Switzerland and the European Central Bank just moved up to a negative 0.3. I can go on. You will literally be charged by the bank if you deposit money there. And the idea is here, from the policymakers, that if we can make it negative, we can make it so terribly difficult for people to not spend, because they want people to spend, take on debt, get aggressive, grow economies that way. Of course, that's not a foundation that's very good for long-term stability. But that's the latest idea. This particular individual, Andrew Haldane, Bank of England, says this is a radical and durable option, a government-backed electronic wallet. It would allow negative interest rates to be levied on currency easily and speedily. There's other guys like Lord Adair Turner, another Brit, who, you know, is pushing very hard. And there's a large number of economists that agree with him. They just want to credit money directly to every household. Just give money to central to governments. And one thing for sure, if you give money to governments, you're going to spend it. So that probably will be working. But these are the kinds of ideas that are going on. These guys think they're brilliant. And these are just immoral policies. They really are. And they're going to bring some very, very bad results for us, the world overall. So just to conclude here, creating money out of thin air, they're arguing that we should have a cashless society simply because if you have to go the route of having negative interest rates as a policy, then everybody's going to be better off taking their money stuck at the till. So but they don't want you to do that. They want you to be part of the financial system. So policymakers, you know, are already arguing that we have to go to a cashless society just so we can support the policy of negative interest rates. So that's the world we're in. These are desperate solutions. They're immoral. Of course, they would regard them to be amoral, but they're immoral because they caused huge, huge wealth transfers. And we're seeing it right before our eyes. And I wish I had more time to explain it to you. So I've talked about a couple of current events, themes. Not really gone into a whole lot of details, I should say. But these are times of significant change. I can't believe some of these policies that are being recommended and put in place around the world because they aren't going to be a good solution at all. This wealth view that I talked about earlier, already being that extreme, it's only going to get more extreme. Because these kinds of policies, they disenfranchise large parts of the population. What's different also about these trends that I've been talking about? They're global this time. It's not like central banks haven't been in problems like this over the last 300, 400, 500 years. What's different today, as I often point out, these are global phenomena. Last year I pointed out that central banking itself, we only had 14 central banks in the year 1900. And we have 180 central banks today. They're all into the same money system, all coordinated, and certainly fits in with what we know will happen in the tribulation period. Revelation 13, was it verses 16, 17, talks about a world where I call them the last financial guru, the false prophet, will put in place that new monetary system where you have to take the sign before you can buy and sell. So we're well on the route to that. Okay, I'm going to tie up a couple of things here. Back to China. I think the Bible tells us that as much as China is going to make a lot of waves yet in the future, and there's going to be a lot of geopolitical shifts, China does not gain a final role as a world hegemon. We can speculate here, and I will in a minute, as to what possibly could happen. We can ask the question, what conditions and catalysts would cause the kings of the East to go west across the Euphrates? I don't know, but could it be a big economic battle? Could it be a geopolitical battle? Could it be... We don't know. Do the 10 kings come on the scene and start muscling around, and we get a disenfranchised kings of the East who, you know, pick up their stakes and head west? We don't know. It could very well be that the global 10-king coalition, think about that for a moment. Why would 10 countries come together? I personally believe those kings are countries. Why would 10 come together if one superpower couldn't do the job? Today we're still living in a world where we have a superpower, that being America. You don't need 10 kings because this one superpower is stronger than any 10 kings right now. But what we know, the Bible tells us, a 10-king coalition does come for a very short time. What are the conditions that cause that those to come together? Is it possibly a competitive situation that arises with the King of the East? We don't know. What we can conclude is that the next decades, years, we don't know how far in the future, you can be sure there's going to be a lot of geopolitical tumult. We haven't seen anything yet. And again, you can ask the question for America. Where is America in this scenario? And if America indeed was to continue to be the world superpower, is it going to be part of that 10 kings, or is it because it may not be on the scene? A lot of speculative questions, but I think there's some very interesting ones begging for what America's role would be. Now, what one will run into a lot, and I get a lot of emails from our readers of Eternal Value Review, and it's hard not to run into doomsters who will put fear into everyone about certain crash scenarios and the dollar, U.S. dollar is going to collapse and all the rest of it. What to do about that? And myself, I have to live in Canada. I've always worked globally. My perspectives have always been oriented globally, so I might see things a little differently than others do. Whereas I think yourselves as citizens here in the United States that look around and say, my gosh, things are deteriorating. They are. But, for somebody like myself, who's looking at things in a global relative plane, I'm only speaking here from an economic point of view, not a moral one. America is, I call it, sort of the best neighbor, the best house in a bad lot. Things are just worse elsewhere. So, yes, what you're seeing here in terms of monetary conditions, debt levels, we can go on and on and list all kinds of things. Yes, they're deteriorating. There's no question about it from an absolute point of view. But looked at internationally, America is viewed as still a safe haven. If you're living over in, let's say, Europe right now, or Japan, and the bank is offering you minus 0.3%, and you have these huge economic dislocations going on in Europe and all kinds of stuff, it looks very dire longer term, America doesn't look so bad. Now, I'm not recommending that you make any investment decisions on that, but I'm just trying to give you that perspective. You really do need to look at things globally, see things how play out. So back to the question here, is a big crash imminent? I get that question all the time. And my answer to people is the entire history of mankind has been pockmarked by financial crises. It's just a fact of the human economy, human financial systems. The global financial crisis we've seen, yes, it's been one of the worst in a long, long time. Possibly it is one of the worst, but it's not that extraordinary. These will continue. In fact, we could have a crisis period next year. There's lots of things that can trigger it. It's hardly worth trying to predict it. But I'm just saying it's part of the human condition. It's part of the financial system. And yes, the world will see a financial collapse someday. The Bible tells us when it will happen. Yes, definitely, it will happen in the tribulation period. It's a real question. It will happen. But remember that Satan needs crises. It's crises that bring the conditions that create the consensus for policymakers to get together to bring in these crazy policies, worse monetary policies, all that kind of thing, to get them to change things. It takes crises often to get these consensus points thrust through. And so we'll get more of them. And I don't know how many. But it's not the big crash. So don't let people scare you into this big crash happening. Satan needs a functioning financial system. And in fact, we're in an environment, and certainly that's the characteristic of Satan, is deception. Massive deception and corruption going on right now, certainly in my view. And in those kinds of environments, you have to be very, very careful. There is nothing, let me put it this way, it's very possible that some of the policies that I talked about, certainly the infrastructure spending policies that China has and other countries are wanting to initiate, it's very possible that we can still have another economic boom. I'm not necessarily predicting it, but I'm saying it's very possible, and it fits in with the storyline of the last days. People are going to be lured in to the good things, as in the days of Noah. And even though everything is crumbling underneath, it's the apparent perceptions that are false and deceptive will continue to lure many people in, including Christians. So we have to keep that in mind, that just because things look rosier for a while doesn't mean things are necessarily getting better. The underlying condition and the long-term trajectory where this is all going hasn't changed. This is the last book I wrote. I think it was 5 or 6 years ago. You will all know what's in it because we gave it away as a free one here, I think, 5 or 6 years ago. But that's what that book focuses on. How these things play out into the tribulation period and explains all the contributing trends. That book probably has the most Bible quotes of any economic book that you'll probably run across. Okay, I want to cut to the close here. And I want to deal with some, more human personal issues. And the world looks at financial markets, economic policy, monetary policy as its salvation, economic salvation, if you will. And so mankind's putting this onus, this hope, on these systems of mankind. And so, in effect, we're putting a lot of faith in idols. And the Bible has a really... I love the definition of an idol that the Bible takes. It's quite hilarious, but it's so true. I'm going to quote a couple of verses here. Here is Isaiah 40, verses 19 through 20. As for an idol, a metal worker casts it, and a goldsmith overlays it with gold and fashions silver chains for it. A man too poor to present such an offering selects wood that will not rot. He looks for a skilled craftsman to set up an idol that will not topple. So focus on that. The idol, they're looking for something that will not topple. Here's another one, Isaiah 41, verses 7. The craftsman encourages the goldsmith, and he who smooths with the hammer spurs on him who strikes the anvil. He says of the welding, it is good. He nails down the idol so it will not topple. Again, there's a number of verses. I'll give you one more. Here again, this one out of Jeremiah 10, verses 3 to 4. They cut a tree out of the forest, and I think something got lost here, the craftsman. They cut a tree out of the forest, and a craftsman shapes it with his chisel. They adorn it with silver and gold. They fasten it with hammer and nails it so it will not totter. So isn't that fascinating? The allegation here that prophets make against these idols is that they are mankind's fabrications, and mankind themselves has to nail it down. You got to keep, propping it up. And that's definitely what's happening in terms of monetary policies and economic policies around the world. These idols keep toppling. They keep falling. And so they got to run and keep propping them up with these new policies and so on and so forth. And that's exactly what we're seeing here right now. And that will continue to be the great disappointment. So mankind worships what must be propped up. And, and in some applications, inflated by mankind. But again, it's a lot of deception in behind that. So the Bible is very clear about what it thinks of the kinds of monetary policies, the immoral policies that I've talked about in brief. And definitively, the Bible has some very strong statements about it. For example, Micah 6:11, shall I count them pure with the wicked balances and with the bag of deceitful weights? There's, I can count 8 or 9 verses in the Bible that talk about the weigh scales being tampered with. Here's another one. When will the new moon be over that we may sell grain and the Sabbath be ended that we may market wheat? Skimping on the measure, boosting the price, and cheating with dishonest guilt. That's what modern-day monetary policies embrace. It may seem so sophisticated and modern, and it's hard to see through the smoke, but that's what it is. They're rigged scales, and God condemns that. And as Zechariah at this point tells us, it's wicked. It's the iniquity of the people throughout the land, and will be judged by mankind. And as I was pointing out, that's what happens later on in the tribulation period after the false prophet has tried to give it one last attempt to prop things up with that new buy-sell policy. Eventually, it all gets destroyed and collapsed before we go into the millennial period. But we're not there yet. We're seeing all these strains and common threads working through the whole superstructure of what's happening in the world. Again, I presented a lot of that superstructure detail last year, and you'd have to go look at that DVD to get that. So why is this all happening? We're just coming to the close here. There's recent verses here. Having the understanding darkened, being alienated from the life of God, through the ignorance that is in them because of the blindness of the hardening of their hearts. And that's so much of the story today. Many people will look at the ridiculousness, hopelessness of some of the policies that are brought in. But you know what? People want to believe. That's certainly what I see in financial markets around the world. People are worried. They feel desperate. I'm talking about professionals here, not necessarily non-financial professionals. They want to believe, and they'll play ball. And so that's why this can continue a lot longer than we may believe. It's very hard to predict. But that's the point. They don't want to believe God, that is. They have their understanding darkened, but they do want to believe in their own idols and will continue to try to prop them up. One last verse, and I want to come right back to China from the beginning. And this is a lovely verse to close on. It sort of parallels the message that Joel Rosenberg gave yesterday, that despite what we believe from a biblical point of view, theology point of view, we still need to love everybody, even our enemies. And here, interestingly, look what happens to China. Although China, as we already talked about, could be a loose cannon, could be a geopolitical issue here for quite a number of years, perhaps decades, be a bit of a troublemaker. I can't be specific on it. Look what happens to China in the end. And here we see a verse from Isaiah chapter 49, verse 12. Behold, and now this is talking about the millennial period, early millennial period. Behold, these shall come from far, and lo, these from the north and from the west, and those from the land of Sinem. So Sinem, you know, Sin being the Arabic for China. Even the Chinese will worship the Lord and become a believing nation at the start of the millennial period. Thank you very much. That's it.
Okay, we're going to have a 10-minute break, and then Bill will be here to talk about politics and geopolitical stuff.